accessions. Accession number 16850, reel 2.
Mr. Gibson, reel 2. You were telling me that you changed your regiment for Korea.
Royal Irish Fusiliers, yes.
And that the 1st Battalion?
The 1st Battalion, because all the line battalions were the 1sts. They had 2nd Battalions as well, but most of them went to local areas like Aqaba, Egypt, that time of Suez. Because the theatre of operations was always seemed to be Europe at that period, most of the 1st Battalions, that's what we always assumed, were the ones that were sent to do more or less where the action was, frontline duties.
Can you tell me how you came to go to Korea, please?
Well, it was during the 1950s when the Korea conflict began. It was talk of everybody, it was on news. North Korea had invaded South Korea, and the United Nations had stepped in. And knowing literally nothing of the history of Korea, Korea suddenly popped up as a name from nowhere. Nobody knew where it was. And notice board, notices went up on the company notice board that because this is after the period 1950-51 when the United Nations formed a task force, a police force as it was then termed. We were all told it was police force for the United Nations. It was one of the very first United Nations actions, I think. Looking back, I can't remember any others where they actually went to war, literally. But it started off as a police action to police the conflict in Korea, which we very soon got drawn into. And so it was a first, really, a first United Nations thing. We said anybody who was 18 could volunteer to join the Royal Ulster Rifles, who were then in Korea, being sent there as part of the UN force, again, police force. This was just after they started pushing back from the Busan Peninsula, where they were, the American and South Korean forces had been pushed. I volunteered. I was told, well, you'll have to go back to the depot in Northern Ireland, Ballykinler at that time, and be re-kitted for Korea from the European kit to Far East kit, which was olive greens, ski boots, what we called ski boots because they had concave heels and they fell to pieces in the first snows. They'd been stored by the British Army for so many years they were completely rotten. Olive green webbing equipment, all olive green, very lightweight olive green tunics. No winter gear. We didn't know at the time that they did have severe winters. And we were shipped out by troop ship. I think it was the SS Dunera that took us to up through the Mediterranean. It was 8 weeks journey, I think it was at that time, 2 months. And we sailed through the Suez, Indian Ocean, Sea of Japan, South China Sea, Sea of Japan, past Formosa, Taiwan, up the Chinese coast, and then into Japan. And we actually disembarked at Kure, an old Japanese naval base at that during the 1939-45 conflict and the Japanese war, where the main Japanese battleships used to be stationed. We disembarked there and then were shipped up by truck. At that time it was occupied Japan. It was known as simply occupied Japan because the Americans were in actual in power. General Mark Clark, I think, was it Mark Clark or Eisenhower? Well, Mark Clark, who had actually ruled it, we went from Curé by truck. Canadians shipped us up in Canadian trucks, I remember, because they were part of the expeditionary, part of the United Nations force, Canadian truck drivers, army trucks. And they shipped us up to JRBD. Now, JRBD, the Japanese Reinforcement Base Depot, that was its name, JRBD. And it was situated in a little village. I can't remember the name of the village, but it wasn't very far from Hiroshima. You could actually travel up to Hiroshima by train or truck to view the damage of the atomic bomb at that period. And of course, I always remember the Japanese have very subdued. The attitude of the Japanese people in that period, that time, was still, because they were still suffering the effects of the war. The rebuilding hadn't fully started, the rebuilding of Japan, and it was mainly, though they had allowed parts of the Japanese police and force to the police the population, we were to order, if the Japanese police confronted you for any reason, you had to submit to what they were telling you until you could get in contact with the British military police or Canadian military police or American military police, who oversaw them, if you know. And it was a very interesting period. I enjoyed the stay. I went to see a few Japanese temples, the big temples. I like looking at ruins and stuff like that anyhow. Enjoyed the period there. And then I think when we went out to an old army, Japanese Imperial Army training camp. Now, again, I can't remember the name of it. It's typical, because you just get shunted onto a lorry and said you're going out for doing 2 weeks training in, and pep talks prior to going into the Korean campaign, into the Korean Peninsula. So we went to these Japanese Imperial Japanese Army barracks, really primitive. You slept on the floor, and the toilets were like slots, and they were emptied by women from the back while you were sitting on them. Very, very comical. Because suddenly you'd be sitting on this box and the back door would open and a woman would reach in and pull a bucket out from under you and put another one in. Very primitive stuff, you know. And the bath was a huge great cauldron with a fire underneath it. And the camp, Japanese camp servants that were employed by the troops, British, heated this water up with wooden fire burning underneath it, and you all got in it in sixes and sat there while the water gradually got hotter and hotter and hotter, you know, until eventually you were squealing to get out. This was a Japanese hot bath type of thing, but it was the original things that had been left by the Imperial Army. Well, we did all our I would say weapon familiarization. It was primarily to let you understand how to operate an American carbine, an M1, to fire a 3-inch mortar, things that you hadn't done in your training prior to that, because your duties didn't involve that. But they're saying that you may be asked thing, and also to acquaint yourself with enemy weapons, which were old fold-down bayonet type carbine, Japanese style, about 6 foot long, with almost like a flintlock on the top of it. But it was a garand weapon, I think, was a type of old weapon that was called a garand, with a top-loading magazine, flip-down lid. And it said, if ever you need to pick up one and fire it, you know how to operate it. It was also, we did familiarization with American weapons, the carbine, the M1 rifle, the American type hand grenades, to identify them, know what they are, so that if we pick one up, we know it, not to pull the wrong thing. Japanese stick grenades and Chinese stick grenades, which were funny things. They looked like a club with a metal band around the bottom and a string at the back. Pull the string and throw it. You know, string came out of the back of the wooden handle and you threw it. But the prime object there was to teach you to fire a 3-inch mortar into the Japanese hills, which were the target areas. We had the hill range. Fire 2-inch mortars. Identify French weapons, American weapons, and nothing else. And then, of course, pep talk. So the pep talk went something like from the visiting colonels and thing who came down to view the troops in their training. You had 2 weeks intensive training, actually, where the American instructors took you through a valley where they had pop-up targets, and you were supposedly going down a ravine in Korea. And the Chinese, who are good at hiding, would pop up out of the ground or out of a little hole, and you had to identify whether it was a wild pig or a Chinaman or a Korean, a North Korean. And of course you had to let rip with whatever weapon you were carrying, and you were scored. You know, the instructor walked immediately behind you, and he didn't tell you where the targets were, that they were up a tree or they were coming out of a hole in the ground. And it was to familiarize yourself with the tension that you would need when you were walking through a battle area. Anything could happen, and you had to be prepared to react very quickly. Needless to say, a lot of scores, bullets were wasted, they were fired in the air and all sorts, but that's by the by. It was good fun while it lasted, and we all thoroughly enjoyed it. But the pep talks were the ones that I always remember. And to this day, you probably hear ex-Korean veterans or saying that if they ever heard these pep talks, the colonel's standing there saying, "Now, don't worry, chaps. You know, these people have got hardly any weapons. They share one rifle between six men. So it said one in every six has got a rifle. Didn't tell us the other five had burp guns." I mean, that was omitted. So it was a total surprise when we suddenly ran into Chinese troops all equipped with burp guns, rapid one way. We had an old 303 bolt action. Though we had good firing rate from them, because the British Army trained very well with the old 303, and we had a high rate of fire, not always accurate, but a very high rate of fire, flipping the bolt up and down. But all they had to do was point the burp gun at you and pull the trigger, and about 50 bullets were coming your way in a flash, much faster than we could ever return them, the weight of fire. My first encounter with those was horrendous, because when I ran into, which will come later in when you ask me, but when I ran into a roadblock trying to escape from the Imjin River,
we'll come on to that later in due course.
I can't go on, because
what else happened in Japan with the training then? Can you remember anything else of the pep talk?
Well, the training was done on a daily basis, typical British Army efficiency. A training officer laid it out. It was already planned for you before you got there, and you stuck rigidly to it. You were given time out to wander around. We did wander into a few villages. The Japanese were very subservient, seeing soldiers suddenly appear in their village. We never tried to frighten them, because we were never armed. We never carried arms in Japan. The only arms that we had were our own personal weapons, and they were locked in the armories. If you went out, you walked with no weapons, none whatsoever. Didn't need them. The Japanese were thoroughly, thoroughly beaten. That's the attitude that came across. And they were so all in awe of fighting troops, because I think they'd been fed a diet of beware, the Americans will eat your children and the British will eat your children, you know, if ever they get on the mainland. But for a lot of the villagers, they hadn't seen a Westerner. So they were sort of in a bit in awe of you. We walked in. I remember one village we walked through in the evening. We went off because we'd finished our duties, and we were just walking through a village. We don't know the name of them because they're in Japanese anyhow, symbols, their village names. And when we walked in, we went into this, like a warehouse type of building. It wasn't a warehouse, it was a thatched building. And it turned out to be the communal bath, and they're all in there having a bath. Because it shocked us to see all these people, mothers, fathers and children, all stood in a bath of water, like heated up water. To them, perfectly normal. To us, shocking. You know? And they were inviting us to get in, waving us to come in, like, you know, with usual Japanese courtesy. They're very courteous people. They kowtow, and they try to invite you to get into the water, and we were, no, we don't do that sort of thing. We're British. Stiff upper lip type of thing, you know.
So how soon after this 2 weeks training did you go across to Korea?
Well, almost as soon as we returned to JRBD. We were trucked back up to the this imperial camp, and trucked back at the end of the 2 weeks, because there was constantly more troops coming in to do their 2 weeks. And about 2 or 3 days after that, we were told to gear up, ship up. We were going up to an American camp at Osaka, and for transshipment, by courtesy of the Americans, via their shipment area at Osaka, to the Korean Busan on the tip of the Korean Peninsula. So, you know, great excitement. Typically British again. Load your packs up, get it all on your back. About 200 weight of useless material. We always felt that we carried much too much stuff. Kit bags, haversacks, all in the green. Olive green, which was the British Army issue for Korea, and our United Nations berries and our United Nations symbol, but our flying rings and 29th Brigade and 28th Brigade flashes all stitched on our pullovers, and off we went by truck again up to Osaka. I think the name of the place was Osaka, and into an American transit camp there, which was a very stark contrast to the British one. The British one run on British lines. For the British troops to suddenly go into an American camp was like falling out into heaven. You know, everything was laid on. Your meals were brilliant, served there. You could have as much as you like, cartons of milk, big steel trays to carry it on, whereas we used to have to use our mess tins. Typical British Army, you know, field kitchens. But there, all highly polished, highly organized, American system. And as we went through the camp gates, I always remember looking up and seeing this huge board across the top, like a neon sign. Through this portal passes the finest fighting man in the world, the US soldier. I thought, oh dear, you know, nothing like liking yourself. But that was a theme we ran into quite a few times. You know, this is the finest fighting man in the whole world, the US soldier. And we said, well, what about us? We did our bit too, you know. Always felt that. But yes, luxury dormitories with cots, army cots, not like the old British one with three biscuits, what they used to call bedding. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Yes,
the three sections, and the middle section always seemed to part from that section. Your bottom ended up on the springs, you know, that sort of thing. If you didn't make it right, it parted during the night. You had one biscuit end falling off one way, the bottom one, the middle one moving down, and you slept on the springs for the night. But very, very lush. Very impressive. Impressed me, and I was only just turned 18. And I thought, well, this is the American way of life. I'd like it, you know? You know, But we were well-trained British troops. And I'd been army acclimatized all my life, so I accepted authority, is army authority, and the British way of doing things, army way of doing things. I was more or less au fait with all things British.
Now, can you tell me about arriving in Korea and where you went to?
Well, from Osaka, we were put on board an old Japanese tramp steamer, a coastal steamer. Just lie around the decks. It's only a small vessel, but there was American troops, there was Canadians, there was even, I think, some Turks. I'm not sure. I think so. Turkish regiment there or some. But anyhow, mainly Americans, mainly British. And we were the contingent that had finished our training and we were going as relief to our units in designated units in Korea. So on the steamer, again, it shocked me to see the toilets on there, which were the old Asian ones, a slot in the ground and 2 foot plates to stand on. We rubbed shoulders with the American Marines that were on board. I think it was the 8th Marines, 8th US Army, and they took great delight in showing off their skills at weaponry, how they cocked their weapons for inspection with all ceremony, spinning it round on their hands and slapping the mechanism of the M1, and real typical US Marine Corps, this is the way we do it, guy, you know. How do you do it? Watch our slope arms and present arms with an old 303. They thought the 303 was hilarious. The Americans actually looked at our 303 and said, what sort of weapon have you got there, guy? Well, they're the M1 and the carbines and what we called grease guns. They looked like shortened Sten guns, you know, with a very fat barrel and a little bit sticking out. They call it a grease gun for pumping grease in. And all of their weapons were automatic or semi-automatic. And they looked at our 303 and they couldn't believe it, that we were going to war with a 303. Of course, none of us, even they, didn't have an inkling of what was coming or what was to come. They'd come straight from the States, you see. And it took us about 18 or 19 hours on board the ship. I can't remember too much about the ship because the passage of time has dimmed those sort of areas down. And I just remember that we disembarked at Busan. Busan was in a bit of a mess. There was dismantled buildings, debris. I think this was during the defense of Busan perimeter. When they were pushed right down into a very small area at the beginning of the 1950, I think, is in 50, early 51. And when the breakout finally came, they were on their way up. They'd already gone up north. And the debris was there, the wrecked vehicles, stores by the thousands of tons, typical American stockpiles of KP rations, brown boxes of rations. All this was new to us. We'd never seen anything like it. We were just troops who'd come away from what we considered this civilized area, where everything went by the company notice board. You know, you do this and you do that. You do it at this time, or you don't do it at all. You just do inside time. And to see all this activity, and to see the peasants run around in little baggy pajamas and little half tops and little funny hats on their heads, which is the Korean type of headgear, seemed to come over to us as quaint, funny. Never seen this before. A great adventure. The adventure was still going on. It was always an adventure. And I think from Busan, we boarded, again, American Army trucks, huge great things, bigger than anything the British Army had. We had the 3-tonner, but they must be 20-tonners, huge ammunition trucks, of about 12 sets of wheels, and we all boarded these things. And British, typical British Army, we had all our olive green kit. I always remember this. And we also met a few veterans, British troops, who were there to help us along our way, you know, telling us, you know, well, there's your trucks are out here, you get on here, you're going up the front, yeah, well, you're quite a ride, you know, you'll be a bit bumpy, but don't be worried, you'll be all right. Oh, by the way, are you taking those tin hats? Yeah, you won't need them, dump them. So all the way along the road there was tin hats flying off the lorries. The old army tin hat. They dumped them. They were too heavy to carry anyhow. Nobody wore them. We wore a woolen scarf, rolled up sock, what we call the old woolen scarf sock, over our heads, you know. And all the tin hats were actually dumped. I remember there was hardly a tin hat in among the lot of us. And we drove for, seemed to be hours, bumpy roads, pitted roads, roads that had been torn to pieces by tanks, tracks. Of course, the big push had already taken place, where the push by the United Nations had already gone to the Yalu and been caught in that winter and retreated back to Pyongyang, and the retreat from, well, the return from Pyongyang had now stabilized north of the 38th parallel. It had stabilized at an angle from, I think it's Onsonri, I'm not too sure of the names, to the other one board, one side of Korea to the other, at an angle, which later straightened itself, but it did cut across the 38th, the 39th parallel. And they'd already come back, so most of the rear action was all hustle and bustle. There was transports moving up to the front. There was ammunition by the truckload going up. There was field guns moving up, huge great howitzers moving up. Troops moving, congested roads, and not only congested roads of troops, there was also refugees. They were everywhere. Children crying, and it shocked us when we saw this, because once we'd moved out of Pusan, we crossed the Han River. The Han River bridge was down, had been blown up, and it was a pontoon bridge. So all these huge trucks had to come down the riverbank, get onto these massive American pontoon bridge, which was riding in the water. And as the huge trucks were going along, because it was a bow wave in front, and they were constantly going uphill till they got to the other bank, downhill and then uphill. And it was terrifying, because we all thought, they're going to dump us in the water, like the trucks are going to go over. They didn't. We actually made it to the other side of the Han River. And often remember people saying, oh, look, what's that floating in the river? Bodies were floating down from the north, because it flows from the north to the south, the Han. And there was all civilian bodies, mostly civilian bodies, floating, bloated, caught up in the banks, probably executed, because a lot of them had hands tied behind their backs. And you could see that where the bodies were clustered, where the eddies had clustered on the bank, that some of them were wired together, and probably mostly the North Koreans, who were rather vicious, taking their revenge on villages further up, and they finally dumped them in the river and shoot them on the riverbanks. But all that came later, because we discovered this all later, because we embarked on the other side. We embarked on a train